Iran describes as historic shame the U.S. refusal to return to the 2015 nuclear deal and rejects an offer of informal talks over the accord. The United Nations calling for an immediate funding prior to a Yemen donor conference to prevent large-scale famine in the war-torn country. Myanmar's ousted de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi appears in a virtual court hearing a month after the military coup amid protests against the junta. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Bashar Sanjafi. Good to have you with us. Now, Iran denounces the new U.S. administration's refusal to return to the 2015 nuclear agreement.
As long as the U.S. does not correct its wrong path, there will be no change in Iran's policies. For the last 2 months, President Biden's administration has not accepted to return to his JCPOA commitments, even verbally. This is a historic shame for President Biden. We are practically facing a different administration of what he had promised in his election campaign.
A foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, says that President Biden had a bad start with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran has not seen any changes in the U.S. policies regarding the accord. Khatibzadeh noted it's Washington that needs to initially act and lift the anti-Iran sanctions. He said Tehran will only return action for appropriate action. But the official once again ruled out any informal meeting with the U.S. offered by the EU. He said that the European Union should know that mutual respect and cooperation is the only way to resolve the issues. Well, on that note, I talked to commentator Brian Berletic, and he says that the U.S. and the EU are trying to force Tehran to pay the price for Washington's unilateral withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal.
The U.S. poses as a global leader, and it has obviously made a mistake, an error in judgment, and now it wants to force Iran to return to the negotiation table the U.S. itself walked away from conditionally, and I think the government in Iran is justified in being skeptical and reluctant. The EU's actions acknowledge that the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the deal was the wrong decision, that it was unjustified. They're telling a party of the deal that fulfilled its commitments that it needs to pay the price for the U.S. walking away from the deal. The EU should stand by its at face value commitment that the deal was violated by the U.S., not Iran, and they should continue forward with the deal.
An international conference on the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict has been held in the Iranian city of Qom. It was attended by senior religious and political figures. Topics such as necessity for freedom of the Azerbaijani lands and ensuring the safety of the Armenians residing there were discussed. Participants stressed the need for mutual respect for the territorial integrity of both countries. In late September, a wave of clashes, the worst in decades, broke out between Azeri troops and Armenian-backed forces in the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. The International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors has held a meeting to discuss a quarterly report. The body's Director General, Rafael Grossi, has delivered his statement putting forward several issues, including Iran and its nuclear program. Joining us now from Vienna is our correspondent, Homa Lesgi. Homa, bring us some more details regarding this press. We did a few minutes of it live. I wonder if it's over yet. And in response to a question by reporter regarding this new agreement between the IAEA and Tehran, Gross said that so far so good.
Yes, that's right. The press conference just finished just a minute or two ago, and in that press conference, as you say, Mr. Grossi was asked questions about the recent bilateral technical understanding that was reached between Iran and the agency, and he said again that this is basically a 90-day opportunity, giving time for political negotiations to come up with a solution to what he describes as a very complex situation. At the moment, we know, of course, that all the fate of the JCPOA and also the future of relations between Iran and the agency remains largely on what happens to the JCPOA if Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal cannot reach an agreement and the deal basically collapses. Then this will dramatically reduce the level of cooperation that currently exists between Iran and the agency. which has already been reduced. As you know, Iran recently announced that it's not going to be implementing voluntary measures, including the additional protocol or modified code 3.1 of the subsidiary arrangements that's part of its comprehensive safeguards agreement with the agency. And this all means that the agency is having a lot less access than it used to have under the JCPOA, under the voluntary measures that Iran was committed to. Now, the Director General has confirmed time and again that because of this temporary agreement that he was able to reach with Iran, the agency does have the current verification and monitoring ability that is needed to confirm, you know, the types of activities that Iran is undertaking. But he said that, I think the important part of his press conference today was that he said he doesn't want the IAEA's work and inspections to be a bargaining chip at the negotiating table when it comes to the political talks. So what he was saying is that he hopes that all sides can continue with these discussions, but that he hopes that it will preserve the work of the agency. And I did ask him, well, if we assume that the JCPOA, for instance, does collapse and does not exist, where will that leave Iran and the agency? He did say, of course, that Iran, as an IAEA member state, as a signatory to the NPT, does have a comprehensive safeguards agreement with the agency that does give the agency some level of access to Iran. It will go back to that. But what he was, I think, trying to say later was that the level of access that the agency has achieved because of these complementary accesses, because of these voluntary measures and the complementary commitments that Iran has undertaken under JCPOA, has given the agency so much access in this time since the deal was implemented in 2015 that for the agency to go back would be creating a very complex situation, to put it in his words. And he was hoping that this would not happen and it would not come to that.
Mm-hmm. And one more question, what about the report by the Board of Governors? Is it ready yet?
Well, it's Mr. Grossi himself who prepares this report concerning his monitoring and verification work in Iran and also about Iran's safeguards commitments, presents this report as usual to the Board of Governors, and then it's up to the Board of Governors to decide, to assess it, and to decide if any political decision needs to be made. What is causing quite a stir is that there have been reports, as you probably well know, that the US and Europeans are trying to come up with a resolution at the board meeting that's underway here in the IAEA, and in that resolution to condemn Iran for failing to live up to its commitments and reducing its cooperation with the agency. And Iran has been very firm about that, saying, the country's foreign minister saying that if the IAEA Board of Governors does table that resolution, does vote for that resolution, then Iran would step away from its agreement with the agency. Mm-hmm. And so people here were asking Mr. Grossi what he thought about such a resolution. He did say the agency's work is just a report, that he's not the one making the political decision, and it will be up to the member states to see if that is going to complicate the situation, mm-hmm. or if they should or should not go ahead with it.
Right. Okay, appreciate that thorough explanation. Hamal Esghi, our correspondent in Vienna. The United Nations has called for immediate funding prior to Yemen donor conference to prevent large-scale famine in the war-torn country.
For most people, life in Yemen is now unbearable. Childhood in Yemen is a special kind of hell. This war is swallowing up a whole generation of Yemenis. We must end it now and start dealing with its enormous consequences immediately. This is not the moment to step back from Yemen.
More than 100 governments and donors will take part in the virtual conference co-hosted by Switzerland and Sweden. The U.S. says at least 60% of the Yemenis are food insecure, and 16 million people do not have access to safe water and proper hygiene. Yemen is known as the world's worst humanitarian crisis by the U.N. The years-long Saudi war, coupled with a blockade and the COVID pandemic, has worsened the humanitarian situation and devastated the infrastructure. The United Nations Humanitarian Agency has raised the alarm about a possible mass famine in the war-ravaged country. We've discussed that issue with our guests in our news review program.
The UN's humanitarian agency warns that more than 16 million people in Yemen will go hungry this year as Saudi Arabia continues its war there. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said tens of thousands of Yemenis are already living in famine-like conditions. It said the risk of large-scale famine in the country has never been more acute than now. The agency said years of conflict have created enormous humanitarian needs in all sectors. Yemen has seen much of its infrastructure devastated in the Saudi-led war. Daily airstrikes coupled with a blockade that has worsened the humanitarian situation in Yemen, where the population depends on aid imports to survive. Faraz Najim is the manager at the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, and Judith Bello is a senior member at the United National Anti-War Movement. Welcome. Faraz, U.S. President Biden expressed concern over the war on Yemen. In your opinion, was that concern, you know, for example, sincere? Because he didn't call on Saudi Arabia to lift its blockade on Yemen. If he did, maybe 16 million people won't starve this year.
It's very clear. We know that, the Biden administration is, it goes back to the Obama administration that started and sparked up this war, ignited at the beginning and supported the Saudi coalition and helped them establish this whole, logistical support and this whole war, this illegal war against the people of Yemen that is leading now to, you know, the worst humanitarian crisis. And it's been going on for 5 years, going into 6 years in a few days. They know what the situation is like, and Biden, he was campaigning to get into power, and this was a good tactic for him. And I knew very much before, and I told a lot of the people that I speak with and all the organizations, that Biden is going to do this, and then he's going to not be a man of his word, and this is just a way to kind of get into power. And they're going to find a way to justify the war and the continuance of the war by, for instance, when the Yemenis respond, they'll say that, look, this is a security issue now, and they're bringing insecurity to the region, so we have to help the Saudi regime. At the end of the day, you know, the Americans and the British, they helped and supported and established and strengthened this whole system to, you know, serve their interests and their control of the region. So they're not just going to let it go that easy, and they're not going to just sell out the Saudi base for them. It's pretty much a big base for them, and they don't care about humanity. It's just it's a political campaign to get into power. Now that he's in power, he's not doing nothing about it, right? They're just mere words and articles and things like that, and MBS is still standing, still going to do crimes, and he's not being held accountable even for the Khashoggi case that he also essentially spoke about, saying that I will hold them accountable, the Saudi regime and all the people that are involved, including, the top leadership there.
Judith, what do you make of the warning by the United Nations? And how do you think history will view Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen? The Saudis stand accused of being behind this dire humanitarian situation that we are seeing today in Yemen?
I think that the announcement is very much a matter of concern. History is not only going to blame the Saudis, they're going to blame the United States, because the United States is the major enforcer on this blockade on Yemen. The United States is actually, in many ways, the major player in this, because if Saudi's protecting their own resources, the United States wants to control the access to oil throughout the Middle East, and they need to control the Bab el-Mandeb to do that. So it's really a U.S. Program from the beginning, and I think history will show that that's what's going on. In the meantime, it's very frightening to see that I noticed that Kathy Kelly said that the U.S. Has actually cut back its contribution to humanitarian aid to Yemen. So the United Nations, when they come forward and they talk about how many people will be starving, they cannot meet their goals and how much assistance that they have committed to give to Yemen without the support of the wealthier countries. So the complaint coming from the United Nations is at least in part based on the fact that they know they're going to have a shortfall. In the meantime, the United Nations Distribution Center is located on a U.S. base in Djibouti, and this is how, in a way, they justify the, the Saudi misbehavior of bombing the ports of access and on sea and land, because they are allowed to bring things in from this U.S. base in Djibouti. But obviously they're biased against Ansarallah, who are responsible, that the Ansarallah government is responsible for the welfare of 80% of the people in Yemen. So when the United States unempowers them to actually receive aid on their own, they're basically taking away food out of the mouths of the people of Yemen. At the same time, allowing those ports to go, to continue to be inaccessible, makes it so that not only can people not receive medical care within Yemen, but there's no way that they can leave Yemen to get it somewhere else. So even if they have the capacity to travel for assistance, they aren't going to get it. They aren't going to be able to go where they need to find it.
Okay, thank you very much indeed for your contribution. Let me thank our guests, Firas and Najim, the manager at the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, and Judith Bellum, senior member at the United National Anti-War Movement. Thank you very much indeed for your input today, and thank you for staying tuned to this edition of the News Review.
Let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. The fiancé of assassinated Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi has called for an immediate punishment of the Saudi crown prince for the murder. Atiqa Changiz says there is no longer any political legitimacy for MBS following the release of a U.S. intelligence report on the case. She says that bin Salman must be punished in order to prevent similar acts from recurring in the future. On Friday, the United States declassified a report that publicly accused bin Salman of approving Khashoggi's murder in the kingdom's Istanbul consulate in 2018. But Washington stopped short of applying sanctions against the Saudi crown prince. Myanmar's ousted civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi has appeared in a virtual court hearing a month after the military takeover of an elected government in the Southeast Asian nation. A defense attorney says an additional charge was added to those filed against her during the hearing. Suu Kyi was detained on the day that the military staged a coup d'etat. She's being held at an isolated place. Her court appearance follows a deadly weekend crackdown against anti-coup rallies that left at least 8 people dead. Meantime, security forces have again fired tear gas at the ralliers, demanding the return of civilian rule. The junta took power by making unfounded allegations of widespread fraud in the last national election. The military has defied international condemnation and Western sanctions, responding to the growing pressure at home with deadly force. Now, in Hong Kong, people have staged a demonstration to show discontent with a court hearing of dozens charged with conspiracy to commit subversion. Demonstrators gathered outside the courthouse calling for the release of the detainees. Police beefed up presence in the area to control any likely unrest. On Sunday, authorities charged 47 people with violating the city's national security law. The legislation criminalizes acts deemed to be subversion, secession, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces. Those charged were among a group that were arrested last month for organizing and participating in an unofficial primary poll last July. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
You heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
Benefiting from the innovation and enthusiasm of youth, as well as the experience of veterans in the management of the country. Sometimes, a youth goes to a different places and puts forward an important idea. But they do not listen to him, and then he comes and meets with me. Later, when I share his idea with experts, they confirm that he's right, that it is an important idea, and that the youth will be able to carry it out. Therefore, I believe that the country should make the most of youth's creativity, enthusiasm, and high morale. They are our children. They are the children of the country, and the country has the right to benefit from them. So we can benefit from youth on the issue of managerial positions and on this one. However, when I say that some managerial tasks should be entrusted to youth, this does not mean that we should completely eliminate previous generations. This is not what I mean. In different circumstances, we can benefit from the management of youth and of veterans. This has been the case since the beginning of the revolution.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Some people say that Imam entrusted Friday prayer leadership in Tehran to a 40-year-old man, this humble person. Yes, but he also entrusted that duty in Kermanshah to an 80-year-old clergy. And in Yazd, Shiraz, Mashhad, Tabriz and other cities, he appointed great men and scholars who were in their 70s. Necessity dictates different actions. In the beginning of the revolution, Imam appointed a youth aged less than 30 years as a commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, and he appointed a man about 60 years as a commander of the ground force of the Islamic Republic of Iran Army. In different situations, there are different decisions. Sometimes necessity dictates that you appoint a young manager, and sometimes it dictates that you appoint an experienced manager. When we are close to election time, I will raise more points about the establishment of a young Hezbollahi administration.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
on the news line.
On Thursday, the United States carried out airstrikes against facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki said the raid authorized by Biden had been, quote, deliberate and meant to de-escalate the overall situation in both eastern Syria and Iraq. The military action was said to be in retaliation for recent attacks against American bases and missions in Iraq, which Washington has blamed on so-called Iran-backed Iraqi resistance groups. In the latest such attacks, rockets hit Baghdad's Green Zone, which houses the U.S. Embassy and other missions on Monday. The American military base at the Erbil International Airport had similarly been attacked days earlier. The Iraqi resistance groups and many Iraqi officials have, however, roundly dismissed Washington's allegations, blaming rogue elements. Pro-Western media outlets describe the U.S. air raid on the Iraq-Syria border as a signal to Iran, which they claim is using Iraq's PMU as a, quote, proxy force in the neighboring country, allegations that Tehran has categorically denied.
Joe Biden is a neocon. He has surrounded himself in his foreign policy, his national security advisor, secretary of state, ambassador to the United Nations, the Pentagon. He has surrounded himself with the same cast of characters to a very large degree who took care of foreign policy during both the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. This is a very aggressive group.
Damascus has slammed the U.S. air raid as a cowardly act of aggression, describing it as a bad sign from the administration of the new president, Joe Biden. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, also condemned the U.S. attack as a continuation of raids carried out by Israel on Syria in violation of international law. U.S. President Joe Biden's order to attack the Iraqi anti-terrorism groups on the border with Syria has been criticized both at home and abroad. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said on Friday that the United States had notified Moscow of the impending attack on the PMU facility 4 or 5 minutes ahead of time. The Russian Foreign Minister said the U.S. military is present on the Syrian soil illegally in violation of all norms of international law, including Security Council resolutions on the reconciliation in the Syrian Arab Republic. He said Russia had received unconfirmed information that the U.S. is planning to stay in Syria indefinitely. Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry also reacted to the U.S. air raid, warning against any action that further complicates the situation in the crisis-hit Syria. Also, a number of Democratic U.S. lawmakers have found fault with the legal justifications of President Joe Biden's administration for the airstrikes, demanding that the officials at the White House immediately brief Congress on the matter. Many expected the Biden era to mark a departure from the damaging and warmongering approach of the Trump administration. It now appears that Biden is following the footsteps of the former president.
Really, Joe Biden has a career as a neocon. He supported the Iraq war and the invasion and occupation of Iraq when he was in the Senate, and in a very influential position as the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. As the vice president, he was personally tasked with dealing with the coup in Ukraine and the overthrow of the government, the constitution of a new government that would meet the needs or demands of Washington. And we could go on and on. I mean, going back to wars in Central America in the 1980s, Trump, when some of the liberals who follow and support Biden said when Trump ordered the missiles fired into Syria early in his presidency, that he said that's what made him presidential. So I guess, you know, we have to take it that making war is what makes a U.S. president a real president.
Biden authorized the attack in another sovereign state in his second month in office. Does he really have a change in the U.S. foreign policy in mind? Or are there more conflicts to come?
The world will never forget the gruesome assassination of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
The outspoken critic of the Saudi regime was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Shortly after the killing, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency assessed with high confidence that Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, had personally ordered the assassination. The case turned into a severe political storm, triggering global condemnation of the Saudis. However, then-U.S. President Donald Trump chose to stand with the notorious Crown Prince and rejected calls to condemn him. Trump's White House dismissed intelligence that bin Salman personally ordered the killing. The former American president made no secret of what was behind his unrelenting support for bin Salman. Trump stressed that he did not want to sacrifice billions of dollars in U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia over the matter. The previous U.S. administration blocked the release of the intelligence community's findings into the killing. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, is apparently taking a different course. Biden said during a presidential campaign rally that Khashoggi was murdered and that he believes the Crown Prince ordered the hit. His administration is now releasing a declassified version of a top-secret intelligence report that singles out the Saudi Crown Prince for at least giving the go-ahead for the assassination, if not directly ordering it. Biden has pledged to take a tough line on Saudi Arabia's human rights violations and its war on Yemen.
Biden, I think, is signaling MBS and the world that the United States is getting back on board as a leader in diplomacy, as a world leader. And you're not going to be those things if you're led around the world by the nose by a Saudi feudal prince. That's got to change. Didn't change under Trump. Didn't change under Obama. I hope to see Biden change that.
The new U.S. administration has made some policy changes regarding Saudi Arabia. U.S. President Joe Biden has ended American support for offensive operations in the Saudi-led war in Yemen and has freezed the sales of weapons to the kingdom. These are not looking very bright for the relationship between the two allies, at least for now. The release of the report on the assassination of Khashoggi is expected to further strain the ties between the two sides. However, during a call with the Saudi king on Thursday, Biden told Salman that he would work for bilateral ties as strongly and transparently as possible. Biden and top administration officials have stressed that they are committed to Saudi Arabia's security. Biden has been in office for a little more than a month, and it is definitely too soon to judge his decisions. The Saudi kingdom is right now a major foreign policy dilemma for the White House. Even if Biden is willing to punish the Saudis for their rights violations and destabilizing actions like their war in Yemen, the road ahead for him will be very bumpy. This is because the kingdom is a long-standing U.S. ally with many powerful friends in Washington. Meanwhile, Saudi petrodollars will definitely not be easy for the Americans to resist.
The Israeli regime is infamous for breaking a long list of international laws, which has drawn worldwide condemnation. Back in 2020, the United Nations General Assembly condemned Israel the most, as it adopted 17 resolutions against Tel Aviv's violation of international laws. That's almost three times more compared with the rest of the world combined, standing at six. The Gaza Strip has been subjected to the longest blockade in modern history. In 2007, Israel imposed a land, sea, and air blockade on Gaza. The inhumane blockade severely restricts imports and exports, people's movements in and out of Gaza, and access to agricultural land and fishing waters, denying Palestinians of their basic human rights. All of these actions are against international law. Israel also demolishes the homes of Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds and elsewhere in the West Bank in order to provide land for building illegal settlements. According to the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2334, settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem Al-Quds are a flagrant violation under international law. Adding to that, Israel frequently targets military positions inside the war-hit Syria, hitting more than 500 spots in the year 2020. Moreover, Israeli aircrafts repeatedly violate Lebanon's airspace on a daily basis, which, again, is a clear violation of international law, in this case, Lebanon's sovereignty. The regime is also the only possessor of nuclear warheads in the region. However, it has always refused to accept or deny having nuclear weapons. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls for nuclear transparency, as it has never allowed inspections of its nuclear facilities and has refrained from joining the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Recently, reports revealed that Tel Aviv was expanding its Dimona nuclear facility, which provides the regime with material needed for its nuclear arsenal. The regime is estimated to have between 100 to 400 atomic warheads. That is why Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program. Meanwhile, it has carried out several assassination operations against Iranian nuclear scientists over the past decade, all in defiance of international law.
Well, we don't really need the U.S. Claims for us to believe that Israel is breaking international law. It's been doing that ever since it claimed independence 70 years, more than 70 years ago. And it's the worst offender. There's no question that Israel, it's an occupying, it occupies, terrorizes 70 years. No other country. You can think of Myanmar. It was very bad with its Muslims, but not even one tenth of what Israel does really every day.
3 years after former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration withdrew from the United Nations Human Rights Council, his successor Joe Biden has moved to rejoin the panel for the 2022-24 term. Washington walked away from the council during Trump's term in office in 2018, accusing it of displaying hostility toward Israel. That is why Washington's bid to rejoin the Geneva-based rights body is aimed at eliminating the so-called unfair focus on Israel. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has been widely condemned internationally for its violation of international laws. The occupying regime is routinely on the UN General Assembly's agenda since late 2006 and is condemned for violations, as mentioned, in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Previously, Biden stated his opposition to the expansion of illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. He also said the only way to reach peace between Palestine and Israel is a two-state solution. However, his administration's move to shield Israel against international outcry over its crimes somehow contradicts his earlier remarks about the Palestine-Israel issue.
Of course, it's undermining the UN. The UN's very weak anyway. It's got really no political clout because it's still ruled by the veto in the Security Council, and any reasonable requests and laws are vetoed. So it doesn't really have any a clout now. But it does have these committees, and it does get some kind of press coverage, and it has credibility. People don't see the UN as an evil force.
The Israeli regime's malicious acts are not hidden from the eyes of international human rights bodies. However, Washington's attempt does not only seem unfair, but also undermines the UN Rights Council's credibility. When Israel holds the record for the most broken UN resolutions, the credibility of the UN as a rights body comes into question.
The planned U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan hangs in the balance as reports show Washington plans to possibly extend its presence in the war-torn country. Afghanistan's neighbor Pakistan has now joined the fray, with the Pakistani ambassador to Washington saying the U.S. should consult the Taliban on any extension of a May 1st deadline for a full troop pullout under the Trump-era deal. Asad Majid Khan warned the U.S. against any unilateral decision. Khan noted the Biden administration's decision to extend military presence in Afghanistan will tarnish the cold credibility of the United States.
It is heartening to know that even high levels of the Pakistani government are speaking truth. That is a truthful statement. It is only going to sully the name and the nation of America, my birth nation, all the more that we are continuously sending American sons and daughters off to wars that have no purpose, no reason. And I agree with the Pakistani government official. I agree with him wholeheartedly.
Pakistan is widely seen as a major player in Afghanistan that wields significant influence over the Taliban. More than a year after Trump's administration signed a deal with the Taliban, U.S. and European officials say the militants have failed to abide by their commitments. They say conditions are not conducive to advancing the peace process amid the surge in violence, which they blame on the Taliban. The militants deny this and warn they will resume attacks on U.S.-led foreign forces unless the May deadline is respected.
But the Taliban are a useful tool where at the high ranks, they're basically doing their whatever their marching orders are. And the United States has proven time and time again, if there is no reason to have a war, we'll make one up. We just continuously create some sort of scenario. What realistic threat does Afghanistan and the Taliban pose to the greatest military in the history of the world? None. Zero. They pose no threat to us at all.
The new U.S. administration is rolling back Trump's policy, the withdrawal deal with the Taliban included. On the surface, the U.S. has steadily insisted it does not want Afghanistan to turn into what it calls a launching pad for new acts of terror like the 9/11 attacks of 2011. Some say with Biden at the White House, the United States is using Taliban attacks as a pretext to extend their presence in Afghanistan.
The intention is to keep American troops, Marines like me, keep them in Afghanistan to help continue running the heroin and ultimately do all sorts of nefarious, horrible things and killing war crimes and crimes against humanity, killing ungodly amounts of innocent people in Afghanistan under the pretext that we're fighting some war against a nation which poses no threat and extend military might in line with the global spectrum dominance agenda.
Another theory maintains the Biden administration is under pressure from arms manufacturers to extend its stay in Afghanistan. Earlier this month, a congressional group recommended that President Biden extend the May 1st deadline for withdrawing troops. Word is, two of the group's three co-chairs and nine of its 12 plenary members have had financial ties to major defense contractors. The arms industry soaks up more than half of the $740 billion defense budget and will gain the protracted U.S. military involvement overseas. American author James Michener predicted during a visit to Afghanistan in 1955 that Russia and the United States would invade Afghanistan and both would come to regret it. That prediction came true. The Soviets invaded and were forced to leave Afghanistan in disgrace in the 1980s. Now, impartial military experts in the U.S. and its Western allies say the invasion of Afghanistan was a waste of blood and treasure from the very beginning and that this is an unwinnable war. They also advise the U.S. and other occupiers to seek a face-saving retreat from Afghanistan that has come to be known as a graveyard of empires.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life. Axel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're up to chapter 6, which is the chapter of the etiquette of eating and drinking. We were talking about the adab, the etiquette, the mannerism of eating, and we mentioned a variety of things that need to be taken into consideration by a mu'min, a mu'minah, in regards to what it is that we should do when it does come to dealing with food, when treating food, when being in the presence of food. And from our ahadith that we have, we are able to deduce that dinner is very, very important. There are many ahadith that say that it is makruh for a person to sleep without having had something to eat as dinner. And breakfast is something that has been mentioned. There's a very interesting hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, where he says that after you pray your fajr and you do what you need to, then you should eat something, because that's going to be very good for your rizq, it's going to be very good for your stomach, and it's also going to be good for your akhlaq. Tuhsin biha khuluqaka. Your view of how you conduct yourself, you know, your manners are going to be better on that particular day. The point here is that we shouldn't miss out on the regular daily meals and what it is that we are doing on a daily basis. Now, this is where a nutritionist has the expertise kind of opinion in what it is that they say, where, you know, when it does come to something like dinner and it being makruh for a person to sleep without dinner, you know, when is dinner? You know, not at 10:30 in the night time or just before you go to sleep, because we also have a hadith that say that a person should avoid sleeping with a full stomach because it brings about bad dreams and things like that. So we need to understand all of these things in the combination of what it is that has been mentioned. Anyway, what about the sufra, or the table spread, the table mat? You know, you're sitting in front of a table of food, and this is called sufra. You know that one of the surahs in the Quran is Suratul Ma'idah, in reference to Nabiullah Isa alayhi salam, when he said, Rabbana anzil alayna ma'idatan min as-sama'i takunu lana 'ida. So there are certain etiquettes that we need to observe in the presence of a ma'ida.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است چه فرون نماز و ثواب داره فرون روزه هم داره.
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرندرخکاری اینجا کم سواب داره، دعا هم داره، سواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که این رو گفته بارم گفته دی اون امامشی گفته اگر روزه بگیری سواب داره، همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون سواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
This comes down to one very, very important Islamic approach to food. And that is, you should never be eating alone. You shouldn't be eating by yourself. You should always be eating with somebody. Unfortunately, in this day and age where we are so individualistic in our daily routine, in where we go, in what we do, it's even got to the stage where whoever comes home, the husband comes home in one time, the wife is home in another time, the children come home in another time. You know, the husband doesn't want to wait for the wife. The son doesn't want to wait for the mother. The sibling doesn't want to wait for another sibling. So each person that comes home, even it might be in half an hour or 1 hour intervals, right? Each person wants to eat by themselves. Or unfortunately, nowadays, everyone wants to eat in front of their laptop, in front of their computer, in front of the television. So there's none of those gatherings, you know, that we you know, see of or hear of in the traditional sense. That's kind of unfortunately diminishing. That's a very, very bad and negative kind of way of how, a direction of how families are heading towards. And that's why in Islam it says that we should always be sharing our food with others. Make that sacrifice, wait another hour, wait another 2 hours when there is someone else at home, and sit down and eat together. Eat over the food, break the bread. If you are all alone, invite somebody over, or be somewhere where there are other people that you are going to be eating with. Let me read this hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi. Ahabbu ta'ami ila Allah ta'ala. The most loved of food in the eyes of Almighty God, ma kathurat alayhi al-aidi, is the food that has multiple hands, or the most hands, or more hands frequenting over it. Ma kathurat alayhi al-aidi, which basically means there being more people. The more people there are over the food, the more Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala loves that food. Break bread with them. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty windowpane. And you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there.
economic divide.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Halfway. On this week's show, we'll be looking at the economy of Cuba and ascertain just how the island nation in the Caribbean is reforming its private sector to assist the flow of income to the people of Cuba. For the Cuban Revolution led by Fidel Castro in 1953, took 5 years to oust then-President Fulgencio Batista, is still in place today, which on a political scale saw the U.S. very nervous of its communist neighbor, leading to the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. Yet today sees the revolution as part of the brand of Cuba. However, a major impact on the Cuban economy are U.S.-imposed sanctions on the state, which along with the impact of the COVID-19 virus saw Cuba's GDP fall by some 11% since the start of the year 2020. And along with the state governing most enterprises has given Cuba a very low score on the Index of Economic Freedom, showing the score sinking to just 26.9 points. Well, by not having a significant flow of foreign currencies, Cuba has stumbled on a difficult situation, as the nation, for example, imports around 70% to 80% of its food, which, as we can see on this chart, shows just how much of each food commodity is imported to the nation, with the bulk of imports coming to Cuba from Venezuela and also from China. Let's now look into our first report that studies how Cuba's revolution has been given a brand identity and how it has been able to adapt and reform to suit the current economic climate.
In 1953, a young Fidel Castro gathered together a group of similar-minded people and over the next 5 years ousted then-president Fulgencio Batista. The Cuban Revolution is without doubt one of the most successful and bizarrely one of the most popular in the world, with teams of tourists flocking to the Caribbean island to immerse themselves in the atmosphere of La Revolución, adorning the Che Guevara berets, posing with classic cars, and losing themselves in the vibrant music and culture of the island. But the modern image of luscious beaches, Cuban cigars and cocktails has not always been the norm. The notion of communism left the United States very edgy, particularly during the 1960s with the Cuban Missile Crisis, sparking American nuclear families to build up an image of almost alien-like views of communism, which contributed to even more tension during the height of the Cold War. Yet the revolution has delivered Cuba with an economic dilemma. The US-imposed embargo on the nation has cost its financial status heavily, with some estimates placing the monetary value of the sanctions at around £553 billion, according to the Cubans. And the UN have estimated the value at a more conservative £130 billion over the last 6 decades.
Joining me in the studio is current affairs and impact analyst Mohan Abedin. Welcome. And
thank
Dr.
you.
Stephen Wilkinson from the University of Buckingham. He is also the director of the International Institute for the Study of Cuba. Well, gentlemen, thanks for being with us. Let me start with Professor Dr. Wilkinson. Cuba's revolution, it has molded itself over the years to be adaptable. And today you have the Cuban government who has hinted at lifting the grip on the private enterprises. And there's so many that they run. Hence allowing Cubans to seek extra income that they obviously need. And, of course, the reforms need to come in place. Do you think that this is an example of communism meeting like capitalism, which was embraced somewhat by the Chinese model, in a sense? And could it be the perfect balance between the two ideologies for Cuba?
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Kaveh. Yes, I mean, to answer your question immediately, one would say that perhaps the secret of Cuba's success in the face of